I tell myself, it's not about comparing. But then I start wondering, what can they lift? Are they adding more weight to their barbell than I am? And suddenly, I'm not training. Then I realize, my journey is not theirs. I've earned every step. So I smile. My smile is the shape resilience takes to keep me moving. To put more smiles out into the world, Colgate has supported female athletes for over 50 years with the Colgate Women's Games, the nation's longest-running indoor track and field series for girls and women. Colgate, your smile is your strength.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with David McCloskey. His novel, Damascus Station, a work of fiction about Syria in the early part of the second decade of the 21st century, a state that is completely collapsed now, a failed state. And yet, David takes us inside Syria, inside Damascus, and shows us what the CIA comes up against dealing with state security, Mukhabarat. And the FSB shows up. That's right. The reawakened KGB shows up. Other players include the Muslim Brothers, who have their own operation over the years, and then eventually the jihadists will show up. There's a great deal of tradecraft in David's book, and I recommend especially talking about it because David has passed his book to General David Petraeus, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, along with his other titles, and Leon Panetta, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, along with his other titles. They have read and approved, and David also makes note in a post note that the CIA read his book very carefully several times, many more times, the Publication Review Board, and has approved what David has identified as tradecraft. So, David, I want to have some fun because we're not going to give the story away. We've indicated there's a hero and a heroine and a good bad guy, and we know who the villains are. What is an SDR, David? What do we learn from that right away at the opening scenes in Paris?
Sure. An SDR is the acronym for a surveillance detection route. It is one of the primary tools in the toolbox of any CIA case officer. It's also, in most spy novels, something that makes, you know, it doesn't make very many appearances in most modern spy thrillers. It is essentially the act of plotting very carefully a route, stops, a series of moves on the street of a city as you are going to meet with an asset, whereby the combination of all of those different moves allow you to understand if you are being watched by the security services, typically of the state in which you find yourself. And so in my book, there are SDRs that occur on the streets of Damascus, so that when Sam is going to meet Miriam, for example, or getting to another safe house, he can determine if the Syrians are watching. And if the Syrians are watching, he can abort and go home or continue the route and then go home. So I think this is one of the key misconceptions about surveillance detection routes, is that they're not intended to lose surveillance, which would signal to the surveillant that you are in fact operational. They're intended to determine if you are being watched. And if you're being watched, you move along with your evening or your day, and you do not meet with the asset, clearly. But once you determine that you are being watched, or if you're not being watched, then you go and have the meeting and conduct the operational act.
Our hero and his allies, the Banditos, the Brothers, they're wonderful characters. Think of an extremely AI canine, and you have an example of what the Banditos can do. They train Mariam in SDR. They use a drone. What kind of drone, David? What do we imagine? It was magical, and Mariam couldn't quite shake it. What does the drone do for them?
Well, in my fictionalized account, Mariam is being trained in southern France in all manner of tradecraft to prepare her to go back into Damascus. A crew of Syrian support assets, codenamed the Banditos, help to train her alongside Sam. And they use a micro drone to do that. One of the reasons why I included that in the story was to make it so that it is far more complicated for Mariam as she's conducting her SDR through Nice, in this case, to get black, which is what we would call when you know that you're not being watched. It's also, you know, I didn't include many details on that drone, but obviously the you know, the world of technology that is available today, be it drones, be it the proliferation of surveillance cameras, has made those operational acts, surveillance detection, much more difficult. And I wanted to include some flavor of that in my book.
Yes, and you've used the term already. What is a safe house? How does it function? And why are there, why is there more than one of them in any operational zone?
Yeah. So safe house would simply be a place that you could, typically a CIA-owned or rented property that you would meet with, you'd use to meet agents or assets. And in my book, there's a wide variety of safe houses, some of which are quite luxurious. Others are quite run down, you know, and they could range from the inconspicuous to the not so inconspicuous. But the point being that, you know, it is hidden from public view who actually owns that place, and it's accessible by the CIA and its agents in any given operational location, be it Italy, be it France, be it Syria. Again, fictional world of the book. You would need multiple because you would not want multiple assets to know that there's a particular location. You know, you, basically, you wouldn't share that information between assets. So there would be a safe house or set of safe houses used by one asset and a set of safe houses or locations used by another. So not as to contaminate those two assets, who would never know that the other existed, of course.
What is a dead drop, David?
Yeah, so, you know, if you think about how does the agency communicate with its sources, any connection between a CIA officer and an asset face to face is extremely, it's risky because you are proving in that moment to the host country that that person has a covert relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency. And so limiting direct communication when possible between sources and, you know, and the CIA is advisable. And so one of the methods of tradecraft that's been developed over the past, you know, century, starting with the British up to the to today with the agency, is a dead drop, whereby a there's a prearranged known location where the case officer, let's say, can put something. In this case, in my book, it's a fairly innocuous piece of trash that's been fabricated so it can hold documents. The case officer may go up there, put something in there, and then 2 days later, the asset may come by and also, you know, remove that or put something in there. And so it allows the separation of the case officer and the asset to limit the risk that they're taking on when they're trying to communicate.
And a brush pass, how does that work?
Brush pass would be riskier in many respects, but a similar concept whereby if the case officer needs to pass something quickly to the asset, they may actually, you know, it's kind of what it sounds like. They brush past each other in a public place, usually, you know, predetermined or prearranged so that it's hidden from cameras and it's going to be hard for anyone watching them to have a good vantage point on this. But it allows them to very carefully pass, you know, information or an envelope or a bag or something between two people in public as they go by each other. They won't acknowledge the other person. They won't speak. They'll move very quickly and fluidly in a very trained way, but it allows them to exchange that information quickly, you know, in public and limit the exposure that they have and the time that they have together.
And an emergency signal, why and how is it used and what's it look like?
Yeah. In my book, the emergency signals are a little bit of vintage Cold War. We've got chalk on the walls in Damascus. And the reason for these is that, you know, quite simply, if you have most forms of covert communication, and I'm putting aside a lot of the tech, you know, the kind of the stuff we're talking about, brush passes and dead drops, they're inherently inefficient. There's a real lag in the asset's ability to communicate to the CIA or vice versa. An emergency signal allows for that asset to, you know, in this case, mark up a wall. The agency has somebody that may not even exactly know why they're looking for this, go around the neighborhood on a regular basis to check if an emergency signal has gone up. And if it has, that initiates a protocol around, you know, getting the asset out of the country or going to a safe house or something like that, so that it happens really quickly.
There is an operation planned by the CIA in the book where they're using face recognition, an algorithm named Molly, all caps, and an operation right up to the limit of execute or not execute. Face recognition using satellites or drones, that is inherently uncertain. We have most recently the incident in Kabul at the close of the American deployment, where the decision was made to shoot. I believe they used a drone, but it's not confirmed. And the U.S. government is now apologizing and paying reparations what it can with a family very badly damaged. So to your understanding, using that algorithm, using that face recognition, is it trusted by the agency when they're trying to identify either a target or a risk?
Well, I think, you know, it's one of the reasons why in my novel, in the operation that you're discussing, the senior officials back at Langley in the Near East Division are so keen to have two eyes on the target, so to speak. They have, on the one hand, the cameras, in this case, that are going to compare the face that they're seeing against the agency's databases. In this case, it's a, you know, it's an official, without giving too much away, the agency is looking at an official on whom they have some information so they can compare those photos and the video with what they're seeing in real time. But then also having the eyes, the actual eyes of a case officer looking at this person in Damascus, and both of those things, you know, being sort of compared against one another to confirm that, you know, you actually do have the right target. So I wanted, you know, for a variety of different reasons, some of them related to the plots of the novel I was trying to construct. In my world, the CIA has, you know, this kind of fail safe of they've got eyes on target, and they also have Molly, in this case, the, you know, the AI driven facial recognition software that that allows them to be certain.
What can go wrong and why? You have an example in Sam's mind when he's most concerned about the operation blowing up. You refer to an operation that took place in Ankara during the Cold War, in which the Russians, then the opponents, who are very, very good, and this is their world, the Russians stumble upon or chance upon a CIA officer meeting an asset. What goes wrong, David?
Yeah, and this it's a fictional example, but it's based on a number of true stories. In my book, there's the case officer Sam is in the middle of an SDR, and he is thinking that he's black, but he's not sure. And as you know, as he's getting into this, mind games start in his head. He's concerned, and he's thinking back to this story around a CIA case officer who was in Ankara, who was running a Russian asset, and who went through an extensive SDR, met with the asset, and then a few days later, the asset was in fact rolled up by the Russians, you know, taken back to Moscow and shot. And in this case, what the Russians had done was they had built a bubble around the CIA case officer, meaning that they had extensive fixed and mobile surveillance assets on the ground in Ankara that allowed them to create a perimeter around him such that he never came into contact with them. And so never knew that they were there, but they watched him the whole time, this case officer, the Russians did, until he had his meeting with the asset. And so in my story, what Sam does is he basically has a street method that he employs where he breaks the bubble, meaning he shoots directly, you know, out of the range of where he's been walking and moving at great speed in a taxi, to force the Russians and Syrian teams in Damascus to redeploy around him. And in that movement, in that, you know, hasty movement, is when he, as the case officer, is going to pick up that he is being watched. And so I wanted to both nail in those scenes as much as I could the mechanics of that dance, but also the way that mentally it would feel as a case officer to be worried that, you know, what they would call seeing ghosts. Am I seeing ghosts? Am I imagining that there's surveillance out there? Sort of the case officer equivalent of the yips in baseball.
David McCloskey, he is the author of the new book, Damascus Station. It is a work of fiction based upon tragedy. When we come back, lessons learned writing about a tragedy that is unfinished. The WMD, the Assad regime, now seen in glory by its allies sitting in Damascus. And what are the lessons learned about writing a thriller that is so heartbreaking? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Plan B made over-the-counter emergency contraception legal more than 20 years ago. It's a safe, effective backup birth control option that helps prevent pregnancy before it starts by temporarily delaying ovulation. Plan B is the number one OBGYN recommended brand and the only one that you can find at all major retailers in all 50 U.S. states. There's no minimum age requirement and you don't need an ID to buy it. You can order it through DoorDash and other major delivery platforms too. That's freedom to be. Use as directed.
Today's episode was brought to you by Simple Mills, the feeling of the sun in a delicious snack. From their tasty crackers to their crunchy cookies, Simple Mills snacks taste good and are good for you because they're made from purposefully chosen ingredients. That purpose? Lifting you up, never weighing you down, so you can keep shining through the day. Find Simple Mills at your grocery store.
What if you could get more from what you already do? When you're a Shell Fuel Rewards member, you can. When you join, you'll save 10 cents per gallon on your first fill, 20 cents per gallon on your second, 30 cents per gallon on your third, and more savings on every fill after that. Join the Shell Fuel Rewards program in the Shell app and enjoy life with more. Your nearest Shell station is closer than you think.